Deuteronomy 19, and when you read the passage with me here in a moment, you're going to figure out real quick what we're going to talk about here this morning, all right? I've got just one day to talk, and you'll figure this out real fast, what we're going to talk about a little bit. Deuteronomy 19, verses 15 down through verse number 21. Single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall the charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in the office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused the brother falsely, then you shall go do to him as he meant to do to his brother. So shall you purge the evil from your midst. And the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, and foot for foot. This morning I want to talk just a little bit in our time together about the matter of accusations. This week, if you have watched the news, read the news, tried to ignore the news, you have, what's that?
Nope, there you go, that was me.
But you've still probably heard something about this little incident that happened in the Senate Judiciary Committee this week in the matter of an accusation. So if you are one of the three people in America who didn't hear anything, just to clue you in, the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has been accused of attempted rape when he was in high school by a woman named Christine Ford. And this led on Thursday to one of the more surreal moments in American history. I still like to think of myself as fairly young. This was probably ranks up there as one of the most bizarre things I have seen since in my short time on this earth. And by the way, that's not just me. Left, right, center, everybody's saying this. This was unbelievable. Just nobody had really seen much anything like this in our nation's history. I joke about being one of the three Americans who didn't hear anything, but that's really not that far from reality. The latest that I saw was that an estimated 30 million Americans watched some or all of the hearing on Thursday live. That's not how many watched it after the fact or watched clips of it or read about it. That's just the number of Americans that tuned in live to at least some of those hearings on Thursday. And I must confess, actually, I'm one of the 30 million who did that. I didn't watch all of it. I had a full day, but I caught a little bit here and there. And as far as political theater goes, it was riveting. I mean, this is better than any TV drama that's on right now. I mean, it was fantastic if you just like political theater for what happened on Thursday. Now, leading up to this whole spectacle, which is a good word, by the way, to describe what happened, because there weren't too many people involved in this that really took any of it seriously, I observed a whole host of talking heads on all sides of the political spectrum. I listened to a number of people. I just listened. I didn't do much talking about it. I wanted to, but I listened to a number of people talking about this thing. I read a ton of people, just like you or I, on various social media platforms about this thing. And I just want to make several observations that leads me to think that we need to clarify as Christians how we ought to think about accusations. And I'm not really going to talk about the whole thing that happened this week other than just say it reminded me that this needs to be addressed as Christians. And I thought, well, I've got one day to talk in between before Brother Steve comes back, and so I'll talk about it today. So just a couple of observations. A number of people just listening, and this is true whether you listened or read to the political class, whether you listened or read to the media class, or you listened or read just to people just like you and I, all right, average people, a number of people, it seems to me, base their conclusion on the matter just simply about how they felt about Mr. Kavanaugh. In other words, their decision-making and how to judge or not judge him was just simply how they felt about him. If you liked him, you believed him. If you didn't, you believed her. That's just generally, for many people, I don't know if I can say most, but it was a substantial number of people just that I listened to and observed and read. And like everything I said, like I said, from the political class to the media class to our class, right? Just people, if you liked them, you believed them. If you didn't, you believed her. So I, for one, am a political conservative. So that means that I like Mr. Kavanaugh, generally speaking. This is not a full-out endorsement of him or any way. But I'll just say that when the news first broke that this accusation was out there, the volume of people, when this first broke, not over time, but when it first broke, the volume of people on my side of the political equation who automatically dismissed the accusation before any evidence was out there was staggering to me. So I'm talking about people who agree with me, just automatically said, couldn't happen, can't be true, before any evidence was out there. It was just this accusation. And I had personal conversations with some people who agree with me politically. And when I said, you know, we really don't know anything to make a judgment, the response was, it isn't true, it's a political hack job, all right, or something like that. So the accusation was out there, and it was just simply dismissed by people, all right? On the other hand, there were a number of people who I don't find much, if any, common ground with politically, who immediately jumped on and sided with her. The hashtag believe her or I believe her went viral all over social media. And again, no evidence presented, just I believe her, all right? Now here's the thing, in a fallen world full of fallen sinners, it's not crazy to have things that you think that are impossible to be true. Nor is it crazy to have false accusations leveled. In a fallen world with fallen sinners, it's not crazy to think the things that you believe are impossible to be true, to actually be true. Nor is it crazy to have false accusations leveled. I want to tell you two true stories. When I was in college at Bible College at Maranatha Baptist University, we had an internet filter on all internet access on our college campus. So this is before smartphones for you younger people in here. Sorry, Jerry. All right. Okay. This is before smartphones. Sad to say you were like in diapers during this time period. All right. I'm just telling you right now. All right. All right. Yeah, and an internet filter with everything, so nobody had one of these devices to go around and to get on your internet yourself. You had to go through a computer. Only a few people had their own computers even to access the internet at this time. And when you got on, you had a unique sign-in and password that gave you access to the internet, but there was a filter on it to remove questionable content, and also they also recorded all of your activity on the internet. Not that everybody looked at it, but it was recorded, and if there was ever an issue, it was brought up. It's Bible College. I don't think that was a bad policy, personally, because the internet was and is a potential danger for young people. I think families have the right to do that with their own children, and even men and women can do that for themselves with accountability to other people. So that was there. Now, the last bit of information for the story was that the internet was shut off at midnight, which is bizarre to think about now, but, you know, they just cut access and nobody could get anything. Like I said, you didn't have any other way to get online. Shut off at midnight. And, actually, it was to encourage students to go to bed so they didn't bother other students. I will tell you, that was the real reason, okay? But I, as a junior in college, this particular year this happened, I had a special privilege to the internet in that I could access it 24 hours a day there. And the reason is that I was a security guard, and I did overnight shifts. And for much of those, that involved sitting in a little office and monitoring things, and then you would go out every 20, 30 minutes, do checks in various parts of the campus, and then come back in. And so because you sat there all night, they didn't mind if you did homework while you were doing that. Part of the perks of the job. So, at that time, I did a very foolish thing, and it was extremely foolish. I gave my password to a couple of friends around finals time, because they were crunching to get papers done. so they'd get on the internet and do some research that they needed to do. One day, shortly after that, I got a call into the dean's office for a meeting. The dean of students sat down with me and said, "I have some questions for you." And he handed me over a paper with a whole bunch of websites recorded that were of the adult variety, in which my username and password were on, and he handed them to me and said, "What do you have to say about this?" I was hit in the face. It was like a kick in the face. And I said, "I did not do that. And can you explain how this would happen?" And he asked me a whole other series of questions that really put me on the hot seat. And they were good questions, the questions that he should have asked. I did and do consider him a dear friend to this day. His name is Dave, and I see him at events now and then. I love him dearly. He was a great help and influence in my life in many ways. So finally, I said, and this was unfortunate because not only was he the dean of students, because this was considered an overall student activity in regard to the safety of students, he was also technically my boss as a security guard. I said to him, "I have given out my username and password to several friends, for which I could have been fired for that." And he said, "Well, Dave, I think I believe you, and this is the only evidence I have, but I would suggest to you that you need to have some very difficult conversation with your friends, and your password should probably change." And I went out of that room a little shaky and a little fear put in me for a good reason. Again, he's a dear friend to me. I wasn't explicitly falsely accused, but it was pretty close. On the other hand, stuff that you don't think could possibly be true can sometimes be true. By the way, I did have a conversation with some of those friends, and they're still my friends today. One of them did access that material, and it was a good growing time for both of us in many ways in helping him through that. But it was a difficult time. On the other hand, stuff that you don't think could possibly be true can sometimes be true. I know a pastor who told me this story. One day he was in his office, he received a phone call from a lady he had never met. She had a voice, the way he described it, it sounded a little hysterical by the way she talked, and she didn't really sound like a credible person. But this lady claimed to be the sister-in-law of a guy in his church, and this guy was a pillar kind of a fellow in the church, a guy that seemed to be a mature Christian, faithful to the church for years, the way he said it. So this lady said, "I don't know what to do, but my brother-in-law, this guy who's in your church, has been flirting with me and recently has been propositioning me." And the pastor, was in his mind, the way he said it was, "This cannot be true." She sounded half crazy on the phone, didn't sound like a credible person in any way. This cannot be true. I know this guy, know his family, can't possibly be true. And then she said, "I was really scared," according to this pastor, "really scared because he came over to the house this last week and exposed on her front yard, exposed himself to her." Okay? Now, besides that not being a particularly effective way to woo someone, she was freaked out and scared. And rightfully so, if that happened. And she didn't know what to do. She was a Christian. She thought her brother-in-law was a Christian, so she decided to call his pastor. Right? This is like when you ever go through Bible college or seminary training, they will tell you this 1,000 times. There's going to be things in ministry for which there is no training possible for you. This is one of those. Well, his pastor told me, he said, I didn't really believe it, but I thought, accusations there. And so he said, If this happened to you and you are afraid, I would suggest that you should call the police, because that is a legal matter and that is a threatening thing and that should not be done. It's public indecency. I think he was wise to do that. And he said, "I promise that I will check in with this individual." So apparently she did call the police, And the pastor went to his house, and he said, you know, I got this call from a woman who claimed to be your sister-in-law and said this. Isn't this crazy? And the guy began to sob. And pastor described just bawling his eyes out. And he said, it's all true. Everything she said was true. And so you think sometimes stuff you think that could never happen. That's a crazy thing. It can absolutely be true. So we live in a fallen world where sinful people can do things that we think could never happen. But we also live in a fallen world where sinful people make false accusations for a host of reasons. And those accusations aren't always malicious. Sometimes they can be mistakes. Sometimes it can be vindictive. Sometimes it can be a result of mental illness. A host of reasons why accusations can be made falsely. So how do we sort through accusations? How do we determine, or at least try to determine, what's true and what's not? And I think this question needs to be answered because what I've increasingly found, and not just with the recent events this week, is that people choose simply to believe in what they feel. That is the default position in most of our society. I feel something, not that I know something. So how do we get from feeling to actually finding out, to try to find a method to know something? By the way, I know this is true even this week. For instance, on Thursday, I was watching for a few minutes before Mr. Kavanaugh's opening statement, and I was watching on a, quote, fair and balanced network. All right, you can figure out what that network is. The committee was in recess, and one of the commentators, whom I like, I've listened to him for a number of years. He's my age. I agree with much of his politics. He was asked what he thought about Mr. Kavanaugh could do in his upcoming statement. And he responded, and I quote this because I was so ticked that I went and wrote it down. He said, everything will depend on his performance. Everything will depend on his performance. In other words, if he made a good show, that would be enough, and that would cause people to feel that he is truthful, telling the truth. I was mad, so I flipped over to another channel, and they were interviewing a U.S. senator on the committee. And he was asked if he believed Professor Ford. She had just finished giving her statement. And he said, I do because I like her, and she is brave for coming here today. So on both networks, I heard from two different people who essentially told me the exact same thing. It's what I feel determines what will actually be true. Now, with that said, I want to just look at this matter of accusations very quickly. It really doesn't take that long. This passage is powerful and simple, as well as other supporting verses in the New and Old Testament. I want to look at this matter of accusations from a Christian perspective. And I'm going to borrow an outline this morning from Kevin Bowder. He's a professor at Central Seminary. He wrote about this subject about a year ago. I found it really helpful. I largely already agreed with everything that he said, but I just like the way he laid it out. So I'm going to kind of adapt and borrow some of it. I just want to give credit where credit is due. But he gave six guidelines for dealing with accusations, and I believe they are helpful, and they flow one front to another fairly well. And not only for this recent controversy, but for this kind of thing going forward, because accusations come and go all the time. And we have to have a way as Christians to think through them. So let me give you just six guidelines, and then our time will be done for how we think about accusations. Guideline number one, and this might seem counterintuitive to begin this, but it's actually very important. Guideline number one, we do not have the right to listen to every accusation. We do not have the right. Not just we don't have the responsibility. You'll hear some people say that. Quite frankly, we do not have the right to listen to every accusation. There are accusations that are none of our business. If you or I make a practice of listening to every accusation out there, what you are actually engaged in is the practice of gossip and possibly even aiding slander. All right? And this is true whether it's among Christians, at your workplace, in your school. I mean, you just, wherever it is, in your family. There are a lot of accusations that you just need to say, I don't need to hear that. Because it really doesn't have anything to do with me. Right? There's a part of me, as a sinner, that wants to hear the latest goods on people. Maybe I'm the only one like that, but there's a part of me, I want it, right? The juicy stuff, the good stuff that's out there. There's part of me who want that. I was at a conference last year and had a fellow pastor share something with me about the former pastor of the church that he was now serving in. So this pastor had replaced another pastor at a particular church. And the former pastor of that church was a guy that I went to college with. So I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that he left, and I hope things are well. And I got this kind of awkward look on his face, and I said, was it on good terms that he left? And I got another awkward look and kind of an awkward answer that said, not really. And so I said, you know what, I don't need to know. I don't need to know. It's none of my business. Now, I got to be honest, I really wanted to know. Well, I went to school with this guy, and here the plot thickens. I never liked this guy in school. I thought he was a troublemaker kind of a guy. I didn't think he was a good guy. So, I mean, all of that's influencing my soul that says, I really want to know. I mean, I'll be honest, this is almost a year ago. I still really want to know. What happened, right? But I don't have a right to know that. I don't need to be part of that, even if the accusations were true. It has nothing to do with me. Now, if somebody called me and said, hey, could you recommend so-and-so? He's, candidating at our church. If somebody called me on that, I might want to say, I've heard that there's some potential troubles out there. Why don't you call so-and-so? I don't know any of the details. That may be one thing where I might need to know something a little bit more. But I don't need to know all those things. Don't get into the practice of gossip and slander. There's guideline number one. We do not have the right to listen to every accusation. Guideline number two. Accusers must identify themselves. Accusers must identify themselves. Here, I'm going to quote from Bowder directly in the article he wrote. He said, quote, anonymous accusations carry less than no moral force. And I appreciate that very much. You know the phrase, they say, or some people have said, or I have heard. And when those are coupled with accusations, we ought never to entertain such things. Biblically, this was true under the law. We read in Deuteronomy 19:16 about the accuser facing and giving evidence for his or her accusation. The assumption was, if you read Deuteronomy 19:16 there, was that the accuser would testify against the accused and identify himself or herself. This, by the way, and this is important, we need to recognize this. This, by the way, does not mean that anonymous accusations are false. This is an error that many people make. Just because an accusation is anonymous does not mean that the accusation is false. But it just means what we're saying here is we don't hear them. Right? It could be true. But we don't hear them. Somebody isn't willing to put their face and name to the accusation, we do not hear them. For one thing, as you read Deuteronomy 19:16 and following, the text declares if a person is shown to falsely accuse someone, then the punishment must be excised against the false accuser that would have been placed upon the accused. And you can't do that unless the person has put a name and face to that accusation. So accusers must identify themselves. Guideline number three. Oh, yes, yeah. It's a big, very big deal. And you better make sure that you know what you're talking about if you're going to make that kind of accusation, right? Especially because if the repercussions was that punishment would be brought upon you, you'd be very careful to make it. Third guideline, the burden of proof is upon the accuser, not the accused. The burden of proof is upon the accuser, not the accused. That's the standard that Deuteronomy 19:16 implies when the accuser had to testify against the accused and that there were judges to hear the matter. Job faced this very problem in Job 6. He was presumed to have sinned by the people judging him. And what he says is, no, you have to show that I have sinned. And you know, God doesn't condemn him for that. God doesn't judge him for that. It's just true. This, by the way, is why the accused always goes last in testimony. This week, leading up to the hearing, there were repeated calls that Professor Ford be allowed to speak last against the accused Mr. Kavanaugh. I'll just say that's flat out evil. That is not right, it is not just, and it is not good. Otherwise, the accuser can say things for which the accused can never respond and defend himself or herself. And that is a wicked thing. Guideline number 4, multiple witnesses are required to convict someone of an accusation. Multiple witnesses. You can see that in Deuteronomy 19:15 in our text if you have that open. But also, this is repeated in Matthew 18:16, 2 Corinthians 13:1, and 1 Timothy 5:19. That, by the way, teaches us that the principles that are laid down here in Deuteronomy are not just for the Jewish people. They span all times. So these principles, you can't just say, well, that's the law, the Old Testament law. We're not under the law, we're under grace. Paul and others are using, and Jesus himself are using this in a New Testament context, which tells us that these are principles that span all of human existence. Yes.
That was a common cry during the hearing. This isn't a court of law.
Yeah.
To justify just what they were doing.
Yeah. So, and multiple witnesses are required. The verses teach us that 2 or 3 witnesses are needed. Witnesses do not have to be a person. A picture, a video recording, DNA samples, those can all be witnesses. The key is that the witnesses have to be independent of each other. That means that usually a husband or wife combo does not count as 2 witnesses. You need independent testimony, right? One that can't be jaded by one or the other. Because they can be tainted really fast, yeah. Which is a good thing, right? You know, be easy to tell my buddy, hey, you know, make sure you tell him it wasn't my fault. You know, that isn't an independent, credible testimony. Principle number 5, the witnesses must corroborate each other. Witnesses must corroborate each other. Here's what Bowder points out. He says, quote, one of the worst aspects of the bogus trial of Jesus was that the witnesses did not agree. You can read about that in Mark 14:56-59, another text as well. These words do not necessarily mean that the witnesses contradicted each other. The witnesses simply could not agree on an accusation of a single wrongdoing. In other words, to put it in our day, that means if one guy says he stole $10,000, another man says he was driving drunk, and still another says he punched a man, that does not mean that the witnesses corroborate. Those are 3 separate accusations. And you need 2 or 3 witnesses for each one of those things in order for the accusation to hold. The witnesses must testify to the same offense. And number 6, no accusation can be sustained until the accused can respond. Now, that doesn't mean that action can't be taken before his or her response. For instance, there are some accusations that might mean a person needs to pause for a little bit at what they're doing. You might be a CEO, or you might have a CEO. We don't have any CEOs here. But if you have a CEO of a company, and a credible accusation has come forward that the CEO has stolen the company's money, the board might say to the CEO, you cannot have access to the accounts until we investigate this matter. Right, that's fine to do. Or if a police officer was involved in a shooting and there were serious questions about whether he or she did the right thing, it might be appropriate to place that person on administrative leave, paid administrative leave, till the matter is settled. But there's no room for sustaining an accusation until the accused can respond. Now, none of these guidelines are perfect. Justice in a fallen world is never perfect. You can follow all of these guidelines and have a guilty person go free or have a false accusation stick. In other words, you can do all of these things and still the wrong outcome happens. You might have an accusation that did actually take place, but you cannot produce two or three witnesses and the guilty can go free. That's an important concept. Just because there aren't two or three witnesses doesn't mean the action didn't happen. Right? And Christians sometimes get that mixed up. Not just Christians, even secular people get that mixed up. Well, it's the person is innocent. They didn't do it because you couldn't produce two or three witnesses. That isn't necessarily true. Right? There are things that have happened to me that only I know about. Nobody else saw. You can't prove that, right? So also, at the same rate, you can have people that will produce two or three witnesses and the guilty will go free. You can have two or three witnesses and the innocent be made guilty. There we go. The innocent can be made guilty. You might have two or three witnesses that are wicked and evil and flat out lie. You can have two or three witnesses that actually just make a mistake. They totally did not understand what actually happened. Their perspective was skewed. They didn't see all the information. But they testified that this happened and a guilty person is condemned. Now, we do wish that justice could be perfect in a fallen world. And as Christians, we are the only people on planet Earth to have the answer to that wish. And that is, we long for the day in which there will be a just prince reigning on a throne who not only can have the power to exercise justice, but he also can know everything. So that you won't have to reach back into the recesses of what happened 36 minutes ago or 36 years ago. He will know it. And his justice will be perfect. We long for that day. Until that day comes, these biblical guidelines will help us to work through how we deal with accusations in a fallen world. All right, I'm just about out of time, and hope that just a little thought-provoking for you. And we ought to consider these things as Christians and be careful how we speak about the matters of accusations. Father in heaven, use these words to glorify your name. Bless us now in a time of fellowship and prepare our hearts for the morning worship service that we may adore your good and gracious Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, and lift you up as well. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.